The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Silicon Valley Bank.
Hello and welcome to The Extraordinary Ordinary, the podcast from Women of the Year, which recognises and celebrates the achievements of remarkable women you've probably never heard of, but whose passion, dedication, hard work and fierce determination have changed society, lives and the world in all kinds of inspiring ways. In each episode, we'll be talking to an extraordinary woman about the experiences that led her to create the organisation, found the charity, launch the campaign, or raise the profile of an issue that she simply couldn't sit by and allow to go unnoticed or unserved. We'll discover what motivates and moves her, the challenges she's faced, the joys she's experienced, the plans she has, and the lessons she's learnt along the way. We'll also hear the sometimes surprising and funny answers to the four quickfire questions we ask each one of our extraordinary, ordinary women. I'm Jo Baring. I run an arts charity and I'm a writer, and I'm one of the presenters of this very special podcast. Later on, the other member of our gang, Leonie Mellinger, will be talking to one of the Women of the Year lunch guests who you most certainly will have heard of about what makes the event such a very special and inspiring experience. Now for this week's guests. In the celebrity seat, we are thrilled to have the wonderful Mel Giedroyc. And this week's extraordinary, ordinary woman is someone who has overcome an appalling personal trauma to inspire others and challenge the fashion, retail, and media industries. So today we have a very special guest and one of the most extraordinary, ordinary women that I've come across, Sylvia Mack. Sylvia is a body equality activist, and she is campaigning to change the fashion industry, media, society, calling on them to represent and accept women who look different. Sylvia, welcome to the Extraordinary Ordinary podcast.
Thank you.
Oh, it's lovely to have you here. Thank you so much for your time. So for our listeners, can you just tell us a little bit about you and what you're doing at the moment?
Yeah, so I'm a body image campaigner, and I set up Love Disfigure, which is kind of like runs a lot of campaigns that I do. So it's kind of like the brand name that I use, only because of the word disfigure, as in a disfigurement that I have on my body from scars and an accident that happened to me when I was younger. And love just gives it that positive name. And yeah, so at the moment I'm just out and about doing lots of campaigning and just really helping people embrace their bodies.
So you mentioned just in that introduction that you had an accident as a child and you've been left with scarring on your body. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. When I was 2.5 years old, we were playing around, me and my sister, who's a couple of years older than me. We were just playing around, playing a game of hide and seek. And my mum just happened to be boiling some pots of water. And the reason she was doing that was because we often had power outages or power cuts or blackouts, whatever you want to call them. So we had quite a lot of those back then. And so she liked to boil the water so that she had water for our baths. And as there were five of us, and I'm the youngest of five. And we were just playing hide and seek one day, and my sister was counting. And my mum just said, look, don't go into the bathroom. And I thought, 2.5 years old, oh, great place to hide. Went and hid behind the door, and my sister pushed the door, and I went flying backwards into the boiling water. And it left some severe scarring on my body.
I mean, it just sounds absolutely horrific. Do you remember that at 2.5, Sylvia?
No, I don't really remember any of it, to be honest. I only remember being in the hospital and having skin grafts, being wrapped up in bandages from my neck down to my ankles or down to my feet. So it was quite a old kind of like body process where they'd look for good skin and just remove skin. And yes, it was really, that's all I could remember. Everything else I was told throughout the years from either my mum or my elder sister or my dad.
And how long were you in hospital for that first time?
Well, the first time I was on life support, and I think I was on life support for roughly about a week and a half, because I wasn't supposed to survive being so young, and it was quite a bad injury. And I think I probably spent a few months in there because I had to have quite a lot of skin grafts after that, and just went back and forth over the years, just having lots of skin grafts, skin releases, and yeah, hundreds of operations, hundreds of surgical procedures.
And can you give us a sense, because obviously what you're doing now is campaigning about body equality and coming to, for you, particularly coming to terms with that body and that scarring. So it's full body scarring, isn't it? All over you.
Yeah, it covers pretty much all of my back, and then it kind of like goes across my tummy, under my, I think it's my left breast or right breast, I can't even remember, down my left leg, and yeah, other kind of little parts, little places that probably shouldn't mention. but yeah, and then all the other parts of my body are just where you can kind of like see little pinprick holes and kind of like knife marks where I had lots of skin removed. It was a little bit like, you know, like just kind of like lifting up the skin and leaving like open wounds, and having it dressed every single day. It was probably the worst part of being burnt, was having the skin grafts.
And you had those throughout your childhood, as a teenager, adult life?
Adult life, yep. Still, last year, actually, I was supposed to have 3 lots of surgery, which was microneedling, which I've never had before. Can't even think. Laser surgery and skin grafts all to my back. So, you know, as the years carry on, it's just never ending visits to the hospital and seeing the plastic surgeons.
And are those operations designed to alleviate pain for you?
Yeah, alleviate pain, but also to release a lot of the tight scarring. Just because what happened to me was it left a big hole in my back, so they had to build up the skin first off. And what had happened was, because I was on life support and they really wasn't expecting me to survive this trauma, and because I did, I'd been left on, you know, without them like treating me or doing any type of procedure. Yeah, so so over the years I'd been left with these what they call contractures, which are just tight pieces of scar tissue like deep under the skin, where everything could kind of like matted together, like muscle and tendons and ligaments and all of that underneath my back. And so as years have gone by, I've had these contractures, but the problem with me is I've kind of got used to that and living with that type of tight back and just thinking this is normal, but it was never normal. And it wasn't until I met with a surgeon last year in a different hospital, and he touched my back and he just said, "I am so sorry. I'm so, so sorry." And I literally couldn't understand why he was apologizing to me. But he said, "You know, you should never have been going through this for such a long time. And that's why we're going to do all this surgery now." But I'd been having lots of surgery, but just to sort of like other parts of the body where you've got the good skin with the scarred skin, normally they'd release sort of like those areas and not so much on the back. But yeah.
Oh, Sylvia. So, you know, you've given us a really, it's just sort of a really horrible, you know, insight into the pain that you still live with,
yeah,
on a daily basis, that physical trauma. You talk about trauma, but obviously this happened when you're 2 and a half. You've grown up with it, but can you tell us a little bit about mentally? So when did you start feeling aware that your body was different, or that you didn't want to show people your body? Yeah, you didn't want a swimsuit on. When did that kind of thing start happening for you?
It started when I began secondary school, and I had a terrible moment where we'd been introduced to a PE teacher that decided, okay, we'll all go out and do hockey. And then afterwards decided we would all have showers, and we had to bring in our towels. I wasn't quite sure why I had the towel that day. I think I probably thought it was just to wipe my face after a game of something. But and she insisted that we all had a shower, and I pleaded with her, you know, that I didn't want to shower. And she pulled, like, she made sure that I got undressed, put the towel around me, and she pulled it off me and pushed me into the shower. And so it was from that day I realized that actually, like, everybody's seen what I look like, and it don't look good, and I'm actually, it was so traumatizing at that age. It was such a, you know, it was first day of secondary school, and you know how terrible that is already. So,
well, I mean, school is horrible anyway. You're scared anyway and nervous, and then to have that cruelty from an adult,
it's
just horrible. I mean, it gives me goosebumps just listening to that. So had you kind of hidden that from your peers before, and then suddenly on the first day it was all out there?
Well, the thing is, when I was in primary school, I didn't spend much time in school because I was always at the hospital. And when I was at school, they used to send me straight into the nursery, where I'd get to, like, sleep on the little day beds. And I didn't really spend much time with the other children. So they'd all kind of, like, made their friends throughout the years. And it wasn't until the very last year I got to really blend with the other children, and I realized that they'd all had friendships. I felt a bit lonely, and so when I did go into secondary school, my sister, what was already in that same school, in that same secondary school, and then that happened, so that was quite terrifying. But then after that, my dad had also signed me up to the local swimming club, where my sister also swam, and my other sisters, and it was there that I noticed that people were staring at my scars, because my dad didn't really try to cover my back. He made sure that I wore all the, you know, dynamic swimming costumes like everyone else.
Oh, and how did that make you feel, going to swimming at kind of 11? Did you want to go?
Yeah, I did. I absolutely loved it. I loved being in the water. I loved swimming. I really did. I loved being with my sister because she was so protective over me. But it was knowing that it was that age, knowing that perhaps I might like boys at the club, and it was just a difficult age, and also knowing that there were other children staring at me and talking about me, and it just started to really cause a problem for me, and realizing that perhaps this isn't such a beautiful body that I've got. You know, having a mum that's always saying, oh, you're lovely, you're beautiful, you're, you know, and then thinking, actually, I'm not.
And how did that manifest itself then? You said that it became a problem, and you kind of said, I mean, being a 14-year-old interested in boys is kind of awful anyway, isn't it? When you're kind of trying to work that out, let alone dealing with all, you know, your scarring, yeah, all of that trauma. So how did that come out in how you were feeling?
Well, it didn't really. I mean, I didn't really talk about it very much. But the only thing that I did do, I remember just going back to my mum and saying, I need a bigger towel so that no one can, so just so that I can cover my back. And she knew, and she made sure that was, you know, that I had that bigger towel. But she never come to swimming, so she never really see what went on. It was just me, my dad and my sister. But whenever I went into swimming galas, I always had my sister at the end of the lane waiting for me to get out so she could cover me up. And I also made sure that I didn't sort of come anywhere in any competitions, just because I didn't want to be seen to be, I just didn't want the focus or the highlight or the spotlight on me. It was easier to just kind of like fade away into the background. Yeah, it was quite a difficult time, because there was so much going on, and I was trying to fit in and trying to just be like everyone else, but it was hard. I realised that, you know, possibly not. Maybe I am, you know, a little bit different, and people maybe don't like me or the way that I look.
So when did your shift in mindset happen, Sylvia? So obviously now you're campaigning. Was it, can you pinpoint a moment or an age where you felt that shift?
Yeah, probably when I was about 13, I'd say, around the ages of 12, 13. Then I realised that I was no longer this miracle child, this wonderful, you know, this beautiful angel, that I realized, oh, actually, I'm actually ugly. But it wasn't just thinking, oh, my scars are ugly, or what's on my back is ugly. I was ugly. Everything about me was ugly. And that's what I think, that was probably the worst thing for me, was basically telling myself, you're ugly, and nobody, you know, you're never gonna have a boyfriend, you'll never grow up to get married or have children because you're ugly, and no, you won't have no friends. And I continued to tell myself that. And then I was bullied a few times on the poolside, had some horrible names, like name calling. So I wasn't a very happy young child. I lost quite a lot of confidence. When I was in school, I always sat at the back of the class. And even in PE, I always made sure I was kind of like that girl that didn't want to like throw myself into doing any type of PE just because my shorts were too short and you could see my scar. So I always made sure that I wasn't picked for things. And I'd stand sort of like, when we played like rounders and stuff, I'd always field, but I'd be way to the back of the fence in the school playground where no one could see me. So I tried to make myself as invisible as I possibly could for out of secondary school, and just to make sure that nobody could recognise that I had scars.
And does that make you sad now, looking back at that child, that teenager?
Yeah, I mean, I had happy times, like obviously with friends and my sister. But I also had times that I wished that I'd been able to talk about, perhaps maybe with my mum. And I don't know why I didn't, because me and my mum were very close, and she was always saying lovely things to me. But it's probably she said too many lovely things, rather than explaining things. So it might be why, it might be just the reason why I kind of like turned against myself and become really negative. And yeah, it's quite sad. It's quite sad to think that I was going through that. And I also had pain across my tummy. So I had a bit of an eating disorder where I couldn't eat too much, and I made sure that at times that I'd make sure I'd bring up that food because of the scar across my tummy. It was too tight and it would make me feel really uncomfortable. It was like wearing those pair of jeans or those trousers when you go for a meal and it gets too tight and you want to loosen it, and I couldn't. And I absolutely hated it. So I'd sit in the playground on the bench on my own most of the time. And just most people would come over to me and say, what's wrong? And I go, oh, period pain, or, oh, you know, belly ache. But, you know, they didn't know. They did not know.
What you've described is so harrowing. But now, do you think that girl could look at you now? You are married, you've got children, you know, you've got that relationship that you thought you'd never have. You are campaigning, you've got a brilliant Facebook and Instagram. It's called, as we said earlier, Love Disfigure, where you are posing in your swimsuit to thousands of people. How did that happen, Sylvia? How did you get from that place to where you are now?
It was really funny, actually, because I never expected in a million years for me to ever change. I was really negative. I was suffering with such severe depression and anxieties. I lacked confidence. You know, I went through so much suicidal thoughts, and it wasn't until I think I was about 48, and I was really crying quite a lot, and I went on holiday with my mum. She decided she needed a holiday and I needed a holiday too, and we went on holiday together, and I just noticed a guy was filming me with his camera phone, and I got really angry and upset, and I said to my mum, he can see my scars, he's filming my scars. And she said, no, he isn't. And then we decided to go down to the beach, and we began to talk about the scars on my back, and she was like, she wanted to touch them, which I thought, okay, that's fine, because she hasn't seen them for years. It's like,
this is your mum.
Yeah, my mum. And we were just having a little chat, and she was asking so many questions about, are you in pain, do they hurt? And I was like, yeah, you know, mum, you know. And then I said, oh, come on, let's walk down to the water's edge. And she said, no, she said, it's okay, I'll sit here. So I said, okay. So I started to walk down, and I turned around, and I noticed that she looked really sad. And it was just like something happened at that moment. And I thought, oh my goodness, my poor mum, she's been struggling all these years because of me. Like, I've been such a horrible child. I've, you know, really upset her, and I've done so much, you know, to her in her life. And it's all because of what happened to me when I was younger. So I got to the water's edge, and I decided to just pull off my sarong and pose in my bikini. And I shouted out, mum, look at me.
Oh, yeah. I've got tears in my eyes. You need that kind of upbeat film music playing as you pull your sarong off on the beach.
It was great.
And what did your mum do?
Oh, she was really happy. She began waving to me. And I got back over to her and just said to her, don't worry, we're going to have a great holiday now, because I'd really like cause it to be so negative and always complaining about where we're going to sit and about people looking at me. And the second week of the holiday was great. We had a great time.
And so that was the change.
It
in
was,
mindset.
Yeah. Yeah, just, it was, yeah.
So around kind of 47, 48. And then when you came back from that holiday, what did you do?
So when I got back home, I contacted my cousin, and I said to him, the reason I contacted him, because he was quite good at the work that he did, and we were quite close. So I said to him, you know, can you help me? I'd love to set something up where I can help others. And he said, oh, would you ever thought about putting a video on Facebook? And I was like, oh no, I don't know about that. And he was like, yes, come on. So he introduced me to his friend Sally B, and she actually filmed and done a video, and she filmed it and spoke to me. It got quite emotional, and at the end I showed my scars. But it was very you know, obviously it was the first time that I was talking about it, so it was quite emotional, and looking back at it, I think, wow, was that actually me? Because I can't believe the breakthrough from changing my mindset to a positive mindset, and how much I now embrace my body, and how much, you know, how I feel now, and how I've changed, and all my campaigning. And it's just wonderful. Like, it's just such a wonderful thing. So yes, I just went on to set up Love Disfigure in a Facebook group. And then I went on to Instagram and campaigned, and thought, I'm going to start campaigning against, you know, the fashion industry and the beauty industry. I'm going to do this for everyone who looks different, whether it's on their face or their body, and we can do this together. And I've just got so many other people coming forward saying, oh, I'd love to join in. I thought, why not? Why not be the first?
Because it really is a community, isn't it, Sylvia? It's a community that you've set up. And as you said, it's not just scarring, it's everyone who has, is, it just looks different.
Yeah, so anyone who could have a health condition, skin conditions, scars could be from surgery, from accident. Yeah, it's like anyone who has some kind of visible or a hidden difference, like under the clothing, and they just want to feel empowered, and they want to inspire others. It's just such a great way for us all to connect. And that now there's so many people out there that are online saying, look, this is me, my bikini, and I don't care what people think, and I'm happy the way I look. I just think it's such a wonderful thing. And then you've got all the brands out there that are now, you know, involving people like us in their campaigns. And it's a wonderful thing to see such positive change.
So tell us about some of those campaigns, because you've done some really exciting things, Sylvia.
Probably like my first campaign was one of my best, only because it was a time where I'd not only connected with a swimwear company who supported the campaign and gave us all the swimwear, but I also brought a lot of people together, women, men and children, to a photo shoot that I'd set up, done all myself. And I can't believe that I'd actually done all of that myself, because that just wasn't me back then. I was that quiet, shy, had no confidence person. And now I was out there creating all these things, going, yes, I could do that, I could do it, I could do it. And yet I could never do those things before. And it was like breaking free and then bringing all these people together. And I remember the most wonderful thing about that day was everyone was connecting, and it didn't matter whether they had scars, a skin condition, or some kind of health condition or disability. They all come together, swapping numbers, and you know, and it was just such a great day. And then the campaign got recognised by, I think it was the BBC, and we ended up on ITV This Morning. And I just went on to do so much stuff after that. I can't even think. In fact, the other day I pulled out loads of magazines and newspapers, and I thought, wow, have I done all of this? I can't believe it. I just shocked. And I'm still pulling them out. I'm still finding more.
Good for you. You ought to. And I think what really strikes me is that if there are people listening that are in the kind of feeling really negative and in that kind of really harrowing place, and they're spiraling and having really negative thoughts, what would you, is there anything that you would say to others to help them?
Yeah, I mean, first off, I'd see, you know, what kind of stage they're at, because it's not always easy for people to just go and throw on a bikini and take a picture and say, this is me, I'm fine. And I wouldn't expect them to go and do that, but just find out what stage they're at. And just by listening to them, you can normally see whether they might need some help from a charity or an organisation or a support group, or they might want to just make a friend, connect with someone who's like them, who has a visible difference, which is something that I enjoy doing now. And I have done quite a bit of that. And then you have other people that are at the stage where they go, no, I'm fine, I just want to do what you're doing, how do I do it? And then it's just about talking to them about, you know, changing your mindset, you know, how to become a bit more positive, and just looking at yourself in the mirror and saying, I'm great, I'm wonderful, I'm beautiful, I'm strong, and doing all of those, you know, kind of like self-love affirmations and those types of things, and just kind of like helping them build that up, but not pushing them to do anything and allowing them to do it themselves. And quite often people see my pictures and then they'll send me a picture of themselves and say, went to the beach today. I didn't care. After all these years, I don't care. I've pulled off yet and I'm wearing a bikini and I don't care. And it just feels so good to like hear that and see that and know that I've helped so many people, not just in the UK, but globally. So it's quite a special thing, really.
It really is. And tell us then about what your hopes are for the future for Love Disfigure, for this community that you've created.
Oh, it's a difficult question. Just because, I feel like I want to keep on campaigning, and I just want to be able to have more of a bigger voice and be able to go out and do more talks, but maybe on a global scale. And also, I'd love to start writing books. I'm already like on the laptop writing loads of stuff down because I've got so much to share. And I just feel like, you know, what I've done is just a snippet of me. And I've just got so much more to give. And just keep campaigning, making sure, who knows, maybe I'll be an MP one day.
Oh, Sylvia, please, we need you. I think with everything that's coming out now with you, we need you, Sylvia. You are astonishing. And I think you are quite right to say that there is so much more for you to give. And I know that I would love, and I'm sure our listeners would love to read what you've written, you know, and kind of go into more depth about how, you know, the journey and helping people and giving people the tools to help themselves through. Before we go, we ask all of our wonderful, extraordinary, ordinary women the four questions. So if you're ready, Sylvia, we will
go. Yeah, I'm ready.
Good.
Go for it.
Okay. So the first one is, who is or are the woman or women who have inspired you?
Oh, I've got to say women. My mother, first off, she's an amazing woman and mother and grandmother and great-grandmother now. my mum most definitely is one of my biggest fans. The wonderful Sally B inspired me to continue my work by teaching me and mentoring me how to use social media because I didn't know any of that at all. And my eldest daughter, who nominated me for Woman of the Year. So, yeah, she's got three young children, running two businesses single-handedly. She's an amazing inspiration to me.
And then what is the one piece of advice would you give your younger self?
Oh, I'd just say that, you know, everyone is different. And most people feel the same way that you do about their bodies.
What's the one thing you can't live without?
Oh, this is really naughty. I'd have to say family. Oh. But I do like my tea.
Oh, your cup of tea?
Yes.
How many cups of tea do you have a day?
Don't ask.
I won't. Okay, we'll gloss over that. And finally, the last one. What one thing about you would surprise people?
I'm very witty and I'm really funny.
That's not surprising, Sylvia. You are funny.
My children don't laugh at my jokes anymore. But I think I'm funny and nobody knows that about me. And I think if I do try to be a little bit witty, then they don't get it because they're used to this person who's, you know, seems to be on, you know, that straight path.
Well, because you're being political and you're campaigning.
Yeah. Probably.
Oh, Sylvia, it's been such a joy to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Oh my goodness, wasn't Sylvia moving? Hello, I'm Leonie Mellinger. I run my own business as a communication skills advisor and I'm also an actor. Now, I'm absolutely delighted to welcome actress, comedian, presenter Mel Giedroyc, who, having been a guest and award presenter at the Women of the Year lunch, has become the much-loved and admired master of ceremonies for the event. I asked Mel when she first came to Women of the Year and what her expectations were.
Right, so I was very honoured to be invited. Now, forgive me, the years of late have sort of merged into one, haven't they? I'm blaming the pandemic for this, but I've no idea if something happened in 2007 or 1979 at the moment. It was a few years ago, and I attended the Women of the Year lunch with Nadia Hussein, who won a Bake Off in, again, please don't ask me for a year, sometime in the 2000s, let's just say, let's keep it vague. And I went along with her and I gave out an award, and we were, Nadia and myself, were just so chuffed to be there and slightly fell over ourselves with excitement. Not because Nicole Kidman was in the room, although that was very exciting, but I got to talk to one of Britain's first female master fishmongers, who operates out of New Lynn, which is one of my favourite places in the world, in Cornwall. And I was so overexcited to discuss the New Lynn crab sandwiches with her, which are, let me tell you, off the scale and the most gorgeous thing you'll ever put in your mouth. So it was a heady occasion. And I've no idea when. I had no idea of the scale of it. I mean, it is enormous, not overwhelmingly, sort of oppressively enormous, but there's just a huge sense when you walk in the room of kind of the world is there, actually. And I absolutely love that. I got such a buzz from just walking in. And I thought, oh my goodness. I mean, I love a do, don't get me wrong. Anyone who knows me knows that I love a do. I get very, very overexcited and have to sort of skitter around before I can settle. So expectation-wise, I think the invitation was quite smart. I'd like to think of it as a very stiff carded invitation, you know, those old-fashioned ones which have sort of bits of gold embossed on them. It wasn't, but I like to think of it like that. It was in a London hotel, which you automatically think, oh my God, this is going to be so exciting. There's something about London hotels. I think living in London, I never go into a London hotel. So they're a sort of slightly fantastical, magical place. Forgive me if I do sound a bit over the top. I haven't been anywhere for 18 months, as I'm sure many people listening to this podcast can agree with. So the idea of stepping out into anywhere that isn't my own home or garden shed is very, very exciting to me. So in answer to your question, in a nutshell, I don't think I knew what to expect, to be honest, but I remember feeling incredibly buzzy and overexcited when I stepped into the room.
We are so thrilled and delighted to have had you as our host and very excited that you're going to be doing that again for us this year. How did you find that experience, Mel?
It's a cracking audience is what it is. It's an absolute festival of liveliness, you know. That's the amazing thing about the lunch, is it's just the conversation does not stop, and there's not just one conversation, there are kind of 800 conversations. I mean, you know, get women together and they talk. That's what we do brilliantly, and we are happy to talk about anything. I've had some brilliant conversations at the Women of the Year lunch, mainly about fish and crab sandwiches, with the master fishmonger, who I love. And I have been back to visit. She gave me her number and I went to visit her. That's another thing that's brilliant about the Women of the Year lunch, is that you meet people and you exchange phone numbers, not in a sort of creepy, oh, love, can I have your phone number type way, but just in a, I really like you and I'm really interested in what you've got to say. And I want to carry on this conversation outside of this enormous, rather lovely London hotel room. That's a brilliant thing. We're communicators, aren't we, as women? That sounds really cliched, but yes. What was the question again? We've gone tangential. That's Women of the Year. You start on something and you tangent yourself. There was a lot of heckling. I seem to remember Lorraine Kelly giving me a bit of a heckle, which I really actually enjoyed. I welcome the heckles. I looked over to one part of the room and there was Zoe Ruddy Wanamaker there. Then there were some incredible women from the Royal Air Force. I love a woman in uniform, don't get me wrong. And they were there, sadly not in uniform that day. There are some brilliant people. There was an amazing woman who runs a big chimney sweep firm. And I think she's probably only one of a handful of women in the country doing that. I did ask her, is it still legal? She said, absolutely. We don't send children up there anymore. That was in Victorian times, Mel. Just calm yourself down. I sat between Cressida Dick, the head of the Metropolitan Police Force, and her number two or three, Helen Ball. I was between Dick and Ball, which was just very, very good and possibly, you know, not needed at the Women of the Year lunch. We don't need any Dick and Balls at the lunch. We have plenty of other things to keep us amused. No, it was marvellous. What I'm trying to say is you can be in that room and literally talk to anyone. Everyone wants to talk to you as well. That's the lovely thing about it. All comers are welcome.
What I wanted to ask you is, do you think that we still need to have organisations such as Women of the Year that celebrate women's achievements?
Hell yeah. Yes, I suppose you'd think, look, come on, there are women in lots of top jobs now. There are women, you know, running amazing organisations, charitable organisations. There are tons of women broadcasters. There are women performers. There are women in all lines and fields and areas of life, and many more than were when the event was set up over 60 years ago. But we need to celebrate. The key word here is celebration, I think. It's a joyous and joyful and joy-spreading occasion, I think, the Women of the Year lunch. So, yeah, I would say absolutely. And particularly now, with all that's going on in the world, we need to just remember that there is joy in the world, and we have to celebrate. I sound like I've sort of gone into some weird, you know, we will celebrate, we must celebrate. I don't mean it like that. I just think also women are really, really busy. You know, I know men are as well, but women are even busier. I've said it. They are. We just have to deal with more. And so I think to take time out on a weekday and to all be together in a lovely, gorgeous hotel in London and just say, we've put everything else aside for this couple of hours. Sometimes it's more than a couple of hours, let me tell you. We had to physically eject some people who will remain nameless. No, I'm not going to name them. And just say, we're not going to think necessarily in this time about our jobs and about our families and about our parents that we're looking after and about our HRT that we're trying to sort of, you know, calibrate, and about the thousand other things that women have to think about, our children, you know, all that stuff, and put that all aside and say, this is about us, actually. This is about us concentrating on each other and having a darned good time. I mean, I've probably concentrated a little bit too much on the Prosecco, the conversation, the fact that I'm getting out of the house for 2 hours. Probably concentrated on that a little bit too much. Of course, underpinning the Women of the Year and its whole ethos and what it was set up for by Tony Lovie and all those decades ago is the fact that we can't be complacent, actually. And that's why it must still go ahead every year, because we can't be complacent.
There are still, I think, problems. For example, there's gender pay gap, and that's still an issue. So I think there are still things as women that we have to work on and fight for. And I guess Women of the Year is celebrating, as you say, and so important to do so, and also continuing to support women in their fight.
Yes, and that's the point. It must happen every year because it does provide a very, very important sort of focus for the fight that women still have, the issues that women still have to sort of keep on top of and keep in the agenda and keep in the public conversation. So absolutely, it's a sort of bilateral approach. There's the lovely Prosecco and the, I know I keep talking about that, it's a worry. Lovely, lovely Prosecco. And the celebration and the party and the community and the vibe in that room. But also there's the serious side underneath. And that must never stop. And it will never stop because women are vocal, women are strong. And we have our place. We have a very important place in society, a much more important place than we ever had, thank God. And that's how it must be, and it's how it must always be. And there are still things to fight for, as you say correctly, the pay gap. I mean, I can't even believe that still exists. You know, that's still a thing that women feel they have to sort of pipe up about. It's utterly ridiculous. So yeah, we're in a good place, but there's still obviously things that have to be highlighted and talked about.
The Extraordinary Ordinary was brought to you by Women of the Year. To find out more about the organisation and its history, the lunch and the Women of the Year awards, go to www.womenoftheyear.co.uk or find us on Instagram and Twitter at Women of Year. For more information about or to support Love Disfigure, go to lovedisfigure.org or on Instagram at love_disfigure. Many thanks to our brilliant producer, Claire Lynch, and of course to you for listening. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please share it with your friends, family, and the extraordinary, ordinary women in your life. The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Silicon Valley Bank. For nearly 40 years, Silicon Valley Bank has helped thousands of innovative businesses and their investors move bold ideas forward fast. With tailored financial services and expertise, Silicon Valley Bank helps address the unique needs of the innovation ecosystem across all business stages. Learn more at svb.com/UK. Silicon Valley Bank, built for what's next.